copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Welcome, everyone, to this talk. And let me just briefly, you have the details of who I am, but in relation to this topic, I've been married now for 42 years. That's where I've learned the most about marriage. I have four children and eight grandchildren, and I'm watching my children's marriages now. And I have observed my parents' marriage, which thankfully was a good one. And of course, many other people that I have been involved in counseling, both as a pastor within the church, as a professional counselor, working with the Labrie Fellowship in England for 14 years as well. So I'm afraid those of you who have come who are professional counselors may be somewhat disappointed in some ways, because I'm aiming mostly for folk who are pastors or working in the church. Of how can you help? I have tried to do a class the last term at the seminary where I teach in the United States for pastors, and I sent out a questionnaire asking pastors in the area for case studies on counseling. 95% of the case studies that came back were on marriage problems. So that gave me a clue. This is a big issue for many pastors. So what can pastors do? What can counselors do? We're going to divide this up into two sections, 20 minutes and then some questions and then another 20 minutes and more questions, if I can keep to the timing. So we have different models of marriage, don't we? We have the, in our culture, the sort of romantic fairy tale model. Here is myself and my wife 42 years ago. Whoops, go back. And then my eldest daughter on the right there. When we see people getting married, and when you go into this, you're all dressed up in your fine clothes, and it's almost like you're imagining this is going to be a wonderful thing, and they're going to live happily ever after, and they'll never have any problems. I think the more realistic marriage vows are these that you may have heard, which is a bit of a reality check. Do you take this woman with all her immaturity, self-centeredness, nagging, tears, and tensions to be your wife as long as you both shall live? Or do you take this man with all his lust, moodiness, indifference, immaturity, selfishness, and incompetence to be your husband as long as you both shall live? Now, we know that's not the whole story, but often behind this, the next day even, or the next week, people get into the darker side of dealing with their brokenness, their sinfulness, their self-centeredness. The other model of marriage, of course, is nowadays is that it's a ridiculous farce. It's a silly comedy. And there's a high divorce rate, increasing numbers of people not getting married. There's basically a cynicism about marriage because it doesn't seem to work. And then the third, of course, would be the revisionist view, which wants to redefine marriage as being between any people who love each other. So a man and a man, a woman and a woman, or maybe it'll come to a man and his brother, something like that. Now, there are certain facts and fictions about marriage. We hear in the United States a lot that Christians divorce at the same rate as non-Christians. Do you hear that here in Europe too? I don't see many heads nodding. No, not yet. But in fact, that is actually not true. Couples who are active in their faith, and this is the critical bit, who are active in their faith, are less likely to divorce than non-Christians. The Catholic couples are 31% less likely, Protestant couples 35% less likely, and interestingly, Jewish couples 97% less likely than their more secular atheist friends. And also, most people in their marriages are faithful. to their spouse. They stay married to their current spouse. Something like 80 to 90% of people are not unfaithful within the marriage. So there are some good things, and in fact some people are actually more and more, in some areas of life, some sectors of the population, people are still wanting to get married. So that's the good part of it. So people get divorced, people are faithful, some of course never marry, an increasing number. So where do we look to for guidance in all of this? And the question is, do we look to the Bible only, to Revelation, or can we also get some valuable information that helps us from the scientific world, from reason? Or maybe it's a matter of both. And this depends on your view of how these two relate to each other. And I have another whole lecture on that. But very briefly, I believe that we have special revelation in the Bible, but we also have general revelation that even non-Christians discover things that are true about the nature of reality. And often discover things that are really helpful, what I would call common grace wisdom in general revelation. So Scripture, we believe, is the foundation and framework with much detailed teaching and example on marriage within it. But it doesn't tell us necessarily how to fix broken marriages, what to do and what actually goes wrong, except in broad general terms and in story form. A lot of the Old Testament breakdowns of marriage, of sexual unfaithfulness, are in story form, aren't they? Which are all wonderful and valuable. So we do have to go back to the Maker's instructions in special revelation, and I'm going to look at that in the first half. In the second half, we will look at what can we learn from the common grace wisdom of general revelation on this. So the first point here is that we are made in the image of a Trinitarian God. God in three persons, in his image, four relationships. God himself has relationships within the Trinity. And we are made in his image for relationships. And he made us in his image male and female, a complementarity of different aspects of the image of God. So, and then we are told there in the first chapters about the leaving and the cleaving and the one flesh, that these are the sort of, this is the pattern of the beginning of a marriage. And I'll come back to that theme in a moment. We're also told that in their relationship, Adam and Eve, they were naked and they had no shame. Now, I think this applies to physical nakedness, but I think it also applies to psychological nakedness. That Rob Bell, in his book Sex God, puts it very well when he says it's easy to take off your clothes and to have sex. People do it all the time. But opening up your soul to someone, letting them into your spirit and thoughts and fears and future and hopes and dreams, that is being naked. And that's what a good marriage is, isn't it? It's opening up your soul, your heart, your very being. There aren't things hidden from each other in a pre-fall marriage for Adam and Eve, and hopefully in a really good marriage. But sadly, after the fall is when the trouble comes, isn't it? God has given the designer's instructions in broad terms there in the first chapters. And then in Genesis 3, problems come with leaving. And this is how it's worked out as we see it, is that there's a young man who is too tied, too emotionally attached to his mother. So he can't attach easily to his wife when he gets married. He's still caught between the two, which doesn't allow him to cleave. There are all sorts of combinations of this that happen, but I think that's a very common one, and I'm told especially in Eastern Europe here. So the leaving is really important, letting go of, because now you are one flesh, and the one flesh doesn't mean just sex. It means this is your primary commitment now. This is more important than your blood relatives. And you have to make that deep connection. So there's a powerful symbolism when a father gives away his daughter and hands her over to her new husband in the wedding ceremony. But if that's not worked out day by day, then big problems will come. Intimacy becomes intimidation, doesn't it? Once you're now you have your sinfulness and your selfishness and your shame that you don't want someone else to look into your soul, look into your heart and know what's really going on, it feels intimidating. So we tend to protect ourselves, to shield ourselves from shame. Guilt and shame turn to blame. So when I feel ashamed, I very often get angry with my wife, particularly if she has the one who has made me ashamed or pointed out something that I'm doing that I take as a criticism. Shame and blame, and just as Adam blames Eve in the Garden of Eden, and then he blames God as well, doesn't he, when he is deeply guilty and ashamed. And empathy and trust turn to selfishness and betrayal. Tim Keller, when he's talking about the leaving and the cleaving, he says this: leaving your home environment and getting married is the biggest culture shock that you will ever experience in your life, because you move into a new culture with your husband, and he comes from a different culture, or she comes from a different culture, and now you have to live very closely together. So you get an immediate lesson in cultural exchange here. Because we're in your marriage, you tend to say, this is the way I've always seen it done, this is the way it should be done, this is the right way to solve conflict, this is the way I express anger, whether you like it or not. So you create moments of hell, and you also may have moments of heaven. It takes incredible patience and humility and self-sacrifice in the sense of Jesus putting aside his own interests and coming down, as Philippians said, amongst us into our culture and our world. John Milton, in Paradise Lost, I've added his quote to this wonderful painting by Thomas Masaccio of Adam and Eve leaving the Garden of Eden with all that terrible shame in their faces and in their bodies. Eve covering her genitals, her breasts and her genitals, and Adam just his eyes. Thus they, in mutual accusation, spent the fruitless hours, but neither self-condemning, and of their vain contest there appeared no end. That's exactly what we see, isn't it, with couples coming with problems. They're accusing each other. They go on doing it forever, and neither of them are willing to really deeply look at themselves. That the quicksand of the adversarial cycle, says Daniel Weil, a therapist, the quicksand of the adversarial cycle, each partner feels too unlistened to hear, too misunderstood to be understanding, and too stung by what the partner just said to do anything other than sting back. The adversarial cycle that you get into. Now, as you go on after Genesis, you know, we have wonderful biblical stories of Isaac and Rebecca, of Jacob and Rachel, of Boaz and Ruth, examples of good and bad things within marriage, of favoritism of children, of things like that. We have the wisdom literature in Proverbs and the wonderful erotic love poem of the Song of Songs, telling us that sex is good, that sexual desire of a woman for a man, for her husband, and a husband for his wife, is a wonderful God-given gift, but to be used within certain boundaries. And they use their imaginations, they use their communication, both verbal communication and physical communication, to enhance their relationship. And it's all there in the Song of Songs. And then in the prophetic literature, we have the warnings against adultery, both with God, but also, and the sort of the parallel of Israel and the church being engaged to God himself, to Christ himself, and one day going to be married in the marriage supper of the Lamb. It's a very sacred relationship that speaks of the intimacy one day we will have with God himself. And then all the characteristics that are so often spoken of in a wedding sermon from 1 Corinthians 13 of what is love. And we'll come back to this again in the second half. But just to meditate on each one of these qualities of patience, of kindness, of not being envious or boastful, not being arrogant or rude, not insisting on your own way, not being irritable or resentful, not rejoicing at wrong, but rejoicing with truth, bearing, believing, hoping, and enduring all things. Now, as we'll see, these actually are the qualities that need to be nurtured, and the secular marriage therapists are saying exactly the same thing. They have discovered through research that these are the qualities that you need in a relationship so that it doesn't fall apart. We'll go into that more later. But it's a learning to delight in each other, making your marriage a priority and actually working on it. For so many couples, raising their children, doing their job, getting enough money to live on become the thing that they live for. And they forget to nurture the marriage. And then you go on into the New Testament in Ephesians 5, and Paul encourages all Christians to submit to one another. And then he goes on to show how wives submit to husbands, husbands submit to wives, children to parents, slaves to masters. But and the wives to husbands, they are to submit, to respect their husbands. The husbands are to be willing to lay down their lives for their wives, to create an environment where their wife's good is made to flourish. And she is nurtured. And he is willing to sacrifice everything for the sake of his wife. That is, I think, his form of submission, as it were, to her. He seeks her good. He is, as we often say, a servant leader. He's not using his power and authority in a way that demeans her or sees her as inferior. So love, submission, and service, Christ's example of the use of power in Philippians 2, in 1 Corinthians 6 and 7, when Paul is talking about sexual faithfulness and mutuality, that is the thing that he really focuses on, is mutuality, isn't it? That and in the Greek and Roman culture, this was a really radical thing to say, that you wives own your husband's body. And you husbands own your wife's body. It's a mutual ownership, and God owns you both. And therefore you're to seek purity, but you are also realistically to seek to meet each other's sexual needs and longings, but in a way that serves and is willing to sacrifice your own desires in order that your spouse should have pleasure. And that is a delicate dance, isn't it, within marriage, of how to, because we're different, and so respecting the differences is a really important thing, and learning the differences between men and women, and how to respect each other's personalities is a big part of this. And then spiritual warfare, because I think the devil loves to destroy us in these areas which are so important to God, where we reflect God's beauty and glory in a most wonderful way. In our marriages, we're reflecting something of the beauty of the relationship between Christ and the church. And in our sexuality, with our bodies, we're reflecting something of the beauty of God. And so the devil is right in there, longing to destroy that wherever he can. And Gary Thomas says in his book, Sacred Marriage, you know, marriage is there not just to make you happy, but it's to make you holy. And I think God certainly uses marriage to sanctify us, and having children to sanctify you and change you in a very powerful way. And as you commit to Him and serve Him in that way, you do. Happiness isn't quite the right word. It's not just a feeling of happiness all the time, but there is a deep contentment and times of ecstasy and happiness within that sort of marriage. So, and obviously all part of all this seeking to serve Him and to follow Him in these ways, there is a certain discipline, spiritual discipline, in loving another person well and sacrificing your own desires and needs. It's the putting off the old nature and putting on the new that we are called to do day by day in every little decision, of saying, it's not me first. The Lord comes first, my wife is next in line, and I come after all of that. So these are these are passages, particularly the principles, and we could expand for a long time on all of those. Any thoughts, reflections, reactions before we move on into the second part of this? I thought this question would come inevitably if I even mention this topic. It is a topic that obviously is debated, the question of what does submission mean for a wife to a husband, because it is more explicit in that direction there in Ephesians. And I think that's where we have to see that verse in the context of the whole of Scripture, of the use, how power is used. Power is never used by Christ in leadership in the church or in any other way to put people down or to see that I am superior to you, I'm a superior person to you. It is a responsibility of leadership, of headship, which I think it, in actually as it works out in a good marriage, you know, you are each seeking to help each other to grow, and the husband may give his wife responsibilities in some areas, the wife may want her husband to take responsibilities in other areas. And it's only, certainly in my own marriage, when we have a really difficult decision to make, which neither of us can make up our mind about, in a sense, I think I carry a greater responsibility before God in this role of headship to help our family and our marriage to make that decision. But it's so easily abused, I think, that and I think we have to see it under the umbrella of submitting to one another and what it means for the husband to lay down his life for his wife.
But it seems to me, as I explain this to people, the submission issue, I talk about the idea of men, if they are not in a position, a role of leadership in their families, they tend to become passive, and that it's really important for them to be there. The woman is always going to revolve around the family. It's just in her makeup. The man, if he loses his role, tends to just kind of float away, or he becomes passive. But I don't have any accurate information except my own observations. Mm-hmm. Do you see that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it's not every situation, but what do you...
Yeah, that's a great point, and I hope this picked up your comment. But I think the danger is that we go to one extreme or the other, isn't it? In our fallen state, that's what we tend to do, to walk this line between in this sort of creative tension is difficult. And some men have never seen... They may have been intimidated by a very authoritarian father and therefore never want to be like him, and they may become passive and afraid. And Larry Crabb wrote a book some years ago called The Silence of Adam, where he's trying to encourage passive men to take up their role in their families and in their marriage. And the danger then is they swing the other way and become too authoritarian. So there is a danger on both sides. I absolutely agree with you. And some men do need encouragement. And we need to work together to work out, in every marriage, I think in a way you have to work out what this tension means of the husband being the head and the wife being given equal dignity and equality, and her gifts being recognized and used within that relationship. It's not intended to be, you know, I'm the man, I'm going to tell you what you must do all the time. That is an abuse of power. And for many people, I think, who've come from countries where all they've seen is an authoritarian style of leadership in the government and in the church, they've never seen anything else. It's much harder to walk this balance. It's much easier to go to the extremes, isn't it? Did you want to come in?
In Coffee Morning, the suggestion was made that men always have the need to be the instigators. And the whole room, women burst out laughing. They could all resonate with this.
That men always feel the need to be instigators?
To be instigators.
And you're saying the women all broke out laughing because they saw that as a reality.
They saw it as reality in their own lives. I went home and I said, well, Ari, I didn't want to be married to a woman, so I guess I'm glad you're a man. But
right.
And yet I know that this has been a rub for us, this extreme...
I think women sometimes do. There are many women who actually are quite controlling, and they want to instigate. They want to take charge of everything. And then a man is often becomes passive because he feels shame all the time. So you're dealing with that dynamic, certainly. But I'm not sure. So it's men, in a way, do desire respect. In a way, but I wrestle with this word respect because my wife desires me to respect her as well.